This BizNews production is brought to you by Brenthurst Wealth, South Africa's leading boutique wealth manager, trusted to guide families for over 20 years. Invest better with Brenthurst.
Thank you, Pitt. Is there a forever stocks? And I know I've asked you this question privately for South Africa. 10 forever stocks for South Africa?
That's hard. Because if you look at the criteria, one of them would be being existent for 50 years. I think Naspers could qualify, but you know, Tencent has only been around for 20, 25 years. So apart from that, it probably qualifies. Large global businesses, we don't have a lot of them listed on the South African Stock Exchange. Richemont, I think, could qualify, but I prefer Hermé. Hermé is proper luxury. Richemont is more as components of the business, which is more accessible luxury, which has less pricing power than a Birkin bag, for instance. Richemont comes to mind, Naspers, but they don't qualify real, you know, when you think about it clearly. There aren't a lot of businesses in the world that qualify, in fact.
Is a Birkin bag made by Hermé?
Hermé, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure Davi is going to be very much in that one as well. Interesting point about South Africa and where South Africa is right now. And I'd like to just get your thinking on this. I can recall, and I'm going to talk about Jannie Mouton a little bit later. I can recall listening to Jannie Mouton 20 years ago, and he said, no, there's no problem. People were worried that South Africa was going to become like Zimbabwe. And he said, no, he put the risk at way below 10%. We know what happened in the past week, and I'm not trying to push you into a, hey, the long term has changed. But when you have your president praising a situation or a process which has led to Zimbabwe, which is, I mean, if you'd been a long-term investor in Zimbabwe, good luck to you. Whereas in South Africa, I'm sure there are a lot of people just wondering after that last week, should we be?
Look, I think the political situation in South Africa is worrying. I mean, that is a fact. I mean, you can't get away from it. It is worrying. Having said that, I think there are important differences between Zimbabwe and South Africa. And I think one is we have better structures, both within the system and outside of the system, which can maintain the status quo. I think talking about these enclaves, I think we have these enclaves which are strong and getting stronger. We have a very strong civil society movement, and I include Sakalicha in that, but there's OTA and there's many others, a very strong civil society movement which gets strong support from the broad population, which acts as a bulwark against, you know, further deterioration. So I think there's many factors out there which speaks in favor of us not going down exactly down to the Zimbabwe route. But we have to know that we have to look out for ourselves. There's nobody else going to do it for us. We have to look out for ourselves. And not only in our personal lives, in the enclaves or the things we build around us, the structures we build around us, but also in our investment life. I think you need to take account of the situation around you and deal with it in a way that allows you to not have to think about politics all the time. Because, you know, in South Africa, if you think about politics, you just get depressed.
While we're talking about watersheds, Jannie Mouton's decision to essentially buy back Curro from shareholders and give it to the country. I don't know if you've ever come across anything like that before and what your thoughts are of it.
I think it's amazing. I think what White Monopoly Capital has done for this country over the past 10 years is just amazing. It's not only him. It's many others. These are entrepreneurs who have built big businesses, generated huge amounts of wealth, and they're giving large slugs of the back to the community as opposed to taking it out of the community like the politicians. So, you know, I can only take my hat off to him. Jannie Mouton was probably one of the best business people we had in this country in years and years and years. And this just further confirms his nature. So, yeah, I think it's wonderful.
And he also, did you take him to Berkshire?
He was on one of the trips. I didn't take him personally, but he was on one of the trips that we went to. Yeah.
He was also a huge follower of Warren Buffett.
Very much so, yeah.
How did you find out about Buffett?
So what happened I was at Alan Gray, and then I was playing touch rugby with a guy called Henrik Detoy, and he invited me to come join Investec Asset Management. There were like 10 people there. And I was thrown in the deep end. I said, given these portfolios, you've got to manage, you've got to do, you know, manage these portfolios. And I didn't really know what I was doing. So I started reading. I just started reading up, and I came across in my reading that I was doing, trying to understand what I was supposed to be doing for the clients, I came across Berkshire Hathaway, and I started reading the annual reports, and there's a book, I forget the book's name, and I read that, and then I decided, hang on, I'm going to go to Omaha and see this firsthand for myself.
Making of an American Capitalist, that one.
Rowan, I think it was that one, yeah. There were two or three books out at that time. This is, I'm talking about mid-90s now.
You spoke about compounding. Another thing that you can compound is your knowledge. How do you do that?
I try to read as widely as possible. A lot of fiction, a lot of history. I don't read newspapers except for Biz News. So not a lot of current events, but reading as widely as possible. I think that's the way.
And that guy that you played touch rugby with who's now suddenly found his voice?
Hats off to Henrik. I mean, I actually WhatsApped him the day before yesterday to say thank you very much for saying that, because I think we need more business leaders to actually stand up and identify what's happening. And the more they do that, I think the more support you'll get from the general populace for fighting against what the politicians are doing to the country.
Why do you think he did that, apart from the fact that he has a family connection where he knows the father very well of Boa, who was assassinated?
Look, these things are, you know, these assassinations are happening, and they are going to touch on the lives of people generally, and they will touch on the lives of business leaders as well. And when this happens, I think you'll get this sort of reaction increasingly.
Yeah, Boa van Niekerk. Sakalecha, your involvement there, how did you decide to invest some of your time?
So I about 5 years ago, I came to the realization that I actually enjoyed living in South Africa. I like living here. It's been good to me. The country's been good to me. I'm not going anywhere. My kids aren't going anywhere. They're staying here. They want to stay here. And they're working and they've got jobs and they're doing fine. And I thought maybe instead of sitting around complaining, maybe let's just contribute something to fight against this incompetent government that we have, to help. And because I'm an investor and I invest in businesses, I thought, well, for me, the natural progression would be to join an organization which helps businesses fight against a crumbling state and helps businesses build resilience against a failing state. So Sakalecha for me was a natural home.
And you don't hold back. On Twitter, X, you tend to make some pretty interesting comments from time to time. Yeah. Those who follow you, you follow Bitvillion, your eyes will be open. Why?
Somebody's got to say something. I mean, I think if you have a voice, and I've got a small voice, I think you should say things and point out the emperor has no clothes. I mean, I think it's our duty to do so.
And has the emperor in America got clothes?
I have to say, I'm not American. I think it'd be presumptuous of me to comment about what's going on in America. I don't have first-hand knowledge of that. But from the outside, Trump to me looks just like another tin-pot African dictator.
Yet his supporters say he's a disruptor and the world needed disruption. So what do you think of that?
Yeah, well, I think Ramaphosa's supporter says he's a consummate diplomat.
Now, those of you who follow the Biz News portfolio, you know it's a model portfolio and we play around and I think we have quite a bit of fun with it. We put 2% of into Bitcoin a while ago. And the reason why is because of one of our conversations. Because I asked Bit, I respect Bit's view. You know, you've got all the Bitcoin League and we're going to have a lot more Bitcoin, I won't say promotion, but at least support to come. But when I asked you about Bitcoin, unlike Magnus, who said, I'm not interested, you said, yeah, I'll take a small percentage. So we put 2% of the portfolio in Bitcoin. It's now 10%. So it has been, thank you. It's been a really good return. But well, have you done the same thing?
So I have been buying Bitcoin now for almost 9 years, a little bit every month. Every month for the price of a good meal out, I've been buying Bitcoin and a couple of other coins. So it's accumulated something, and I'm glad I could help out with the portfolio and not pick a SA value stock, which goes nowhere. So I've been doing that, and it's forced me to try and understand what cryptocurrencies are and what the blockchain is and how these things work together. And I think there's something real there, I think it could be significant in the economy over the next 5 to 10 years. Yeah.
It's not the only way you've held out. We doubled down on SabFest last month.
Oh, good.
And in the 90s, and it's now gone up to nearly 120. But what? Why is it your biggest stock in the portfolio? There are a lot of people here who've also got who own it directly because of that.
So just to be clear, it's not in the Worldwide Flexible Fund.
No. It's not the cockroach.
Fund. We're talking about the Value Fund now. And the Value Fund owns good businesses which are trading at significantly below intrinsic value. And SabVest, which is an investment holding company run by Chris Seabrook, is an outstanding business. It has compounded at more than twice the rate of the All Share Index over 20 years. You know, and you just can't ignore that. Yet it's trading at a 30 to 40% discount to NAV. And then people say, but this discount, why should I buy it? Because it's trading at a discount. Well, if it stays at a 40% discount to NAV and you just sit with it and it compounds at the same rate it has done over the past year, you're still earning twice the rate of return of the JSE, even though the discount stays the same. So that's a bit of a red herring for me. And I think Chris invests in good businesses and he allocates capital well. And the market would rather give their money to Woolworths to go and buy a white elephant in Australia for 20 billion rand than allocate capital to a good business like SabVest, which is a local company. And that, for me, is a discrepancy in the market and the opportunity in the market.
I want you just to give us maybe a little bit of a philosophical thought here. Lots of us... As human beings, part of the human condition, if there's something we don't understand and something we don't like, are they stupid? They don't know what they're talking about. You know, Donald Trump, he's a fool. Bitcoin, those guys are talking rubbish. The internet, I remember them. What, the interweb? What's this bookface thing? A lot of those kind of comments come automatically. And I want to ask you about the tech sector. Now, people have been writing off the Magnificent Seven for almost a decade now, the same people doing it all the time. I won't invest there because it's crap, because it's going to implode, but it hasn't imploded. You say that the Socratic way of wisdom begins when I realize I know nothing. How do you approach things like that, these new discoveries, these new areas that certainly will be reshaping or could be reshaping the way we live?
Yeah, and I think that is the responsibility of an investor is to actually, when something comes up, you actually need to study it and try and understand it. And if you think it's wrong, you have to be able to build that argument which justifies it so you can tear down that argument and in so doing prove that it doesn't work. And that's, as an investor, that's your responsibility. That's what you need. And that's what I try to do. Bitcoin, I wrote about my letters 18 months ago. I did a series of letters on that, which is my thinking process around Bitcoin. And I think it's the same for any type of investment, Mag 7, anything else, Tesla. You need to almost disprove your own thesis to prove it to yourself. And that's the work you've got to put into. And that's what you need to do.
Sounds like Tim Nex.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Tim does the same thing. Yeah. He believes that true science needs to be looking at something that you enjoy, but then just trying to disprove it to yourself before you actually accept it.
Yeah, during the COVID period, people used to say, trust the science. You've got to wear a mask. You've got to do this, do that. But science is not that. Science is proving things or disproving them. Science is a gray area of unknownness. You don't know what's going on there. And then you have hypotheses and you try and disprove or prove the hypotheses. Science isn't a settled thing which says this is what you have to do and that's how it works. Science is unsettled and open to being disproved. And that's what you have to do with investment arguments as well. If somebody tells you Bitcoin's nonsense, you know, then you have to actually sit down and think, what is a Bitcoin? What is it doing? What is Meta doing? Is it a viable business model? And so on and so forth. And you've got to work through it yourself. That's the job of an investor.
But do you ever meet up or bump your head against true stupidity?
Outside of politics. Truth is pity. I mean, I've done stupid things in my life. I've been truly stupid many times. So I've bumped into myself often. I can say that.
I'm talking about businesses. You analyze businesses and you look at that. You say, no, these guys are truly stupid in what they do.
You know, I think one thing that, and I don't want to single out any specific business, but one thing that South African business has done that has been truly stupid is buying rubbish offshore because you feel better at buying an offshore asset. And that's been truly stupid. And you can go through it. You can go through all the lists of companies that have bought assets offshore. Because remember, those investment bankers offshore are smart. I mean, they're sitting there waiting for this African to pop up his head above the parapet. And they have 20 businesses they can sell to him because nobody else there wants it. So I think that's one. And instead of allocating capital to good business people here in South Africa, doing good business, creating value for shareholders and for customers and for society at large, they'd rather give it to a company who wants to invest offshore because there's this magic thing called offshore.
And it's emotion driven.
It's emotional driven. It's emotional because we're sitting here with the politics and we think, how can you ever make a good investment in a country like South Africa? But I can tell you there are many great businesses. Some of the CEOs are sitting here in the audience today that have created tremendous value by satisfying customer needs in this country. And it's we spoke about Gianni Vuitton. He built a fantastic business all in South Africa from scratch. And, you know, there's many like that.
Other stupid things like hostile takeovers that have been done or mergers and that kind of thing. How do you get to a view that you say, no, they really can't be this thick? Or can they ever be really that thick?
Well, it's not stupidity. People do what they're incentivized to do. And if you are a CEO of a big business and you have a whole whack of options behind you and you can get the share price up by doing some, with the benefit of hindsight, stupid deal, you're going to do it because you're going to cash in your options and walk away. And that'll be the problem of the next CEO to deal with it. So, but that's not stupid behavior. That's actually very smart behavior. It's incentivized behavior.
Accepting it's for the next people to deal with it, which brings me to BEE. You and I were around right in the early days when BEE came through. It didn't make sense. I had the privilege of actually visiting India and seeing how the Indian economic empowerment was handled after the end of the British Raj. And it was quite extraordinary the way that they pushed money into education. So we had the model. It wasn't something that we had to invent. And yet South African business decided we need role models. And now we have 100 people, according to Professor Gumede, who got R1 trillion. And the rest of society is looking back and saying, oh, hell. Now, was that a truly stupid decision by South African business?
I think South African business was incentivized to do so by the government. They said, well, you're not going to get this contract or that contract if you don't do this or that. So, I mean, these things work in conjunction with each other. It's easy to sit here now and say with the benefit of hindsight that was stupid. It probably would have been smarter to sort of push hard against it at that time, whereas now it's so embedded in the culture, BEE is like a thing. It's hard to fight against now, but we are trying to do that.
I remember interviewing a CEO of a major bank because back then share options, you recall, were not on a balance sheet. And I said to the CEO of the bank, how can you be giving R1 billion worth of share options to Tokyo Sekhwale? And the response was, well, share options don't cost anything. So it's quite an extraordinary ignorance that we had at the time. Here's a question. What positions in your fund are giving you discomfort from Brett Geddes?
Okay, so let's talk specifically about the Worldwide Flexible Fund and not the Value Fund, because that's, I think, the question pertains to how that fund is structured. So right now, the position that's giving the biggest worry, whether it's the correct position for the purpose of the fund or not, is the position in Japanese yen. I think that is an issue. I think I went through a period about a month ago where I was wondering whether Nestle is, in fact, a true 10 stocks forever type stock. But I went through the work there and I think I came to the conclusion that it is. So, but that was a worrying position. For the rest, not really. I think the energy position is another one that right now is not looking very good. But in a world that looks different in 5 years' time, it might be very valuable. Who knows? But right now, it's not doing very well at all.
I've got to ask you about Sasol. What's your take there?
I think Sasol's turned the corner. I am long-term, I'm bullish on energy for the simple fact that this whole explosion in AI is a source of huge demand of energy. I mean, because energy is what drives AI at the end of the day. You can see when they build these data centers, they quote it not in data processing capacity, but energy utilization. So they say this is a 20 megawatt data center and this is a 50 megawatt data center. So they're defining what they're doing in terms of energy. And they are just spending huge amounts of capital in building these things. So I think at some point, and at the same time, because the share prices of energy stocks and the oil price itself is so low, nobody is expanding productive capabilities in energy generally, whether it's coal, whether it's gas, whether it's oil, nuclear is starting to pick up a bit. But there isn't a massive supply coming on stream, but you can see the demand building strongly. So I think if you take a long-term view, the odds of making good money in energy, I think, is high. And if you want to play AI without, you know, if you think back to the internet revolution in, say, 2000, it was hard to pick the winners then. I mean, was it Pets.com or Amazon? Which one would win? And if you put yourself in that position, it was hard to see then. Today, who's going to be the winner in AI? Is it OpenAI? Is it Meta? Is it Microsoft? Is it somebody else? It's hard to pick the winner. But I think energy will be the ultimate winner out of this whole thing. And I think that for me, that's, you know, if you want to play AI, that's a smart way to play it.
Okay, my horse is Alphabet because of DeepMind. Who's your horse in the AI race?
I don't have a horse in the AI race.
Well,
I don't know. I'm like Robin Williams. I don't know.
Nick Jordan asks, is the cockroach, with its stability, a suitable place to park cash for a 6 to 12 month horizon? Or being a fund, would this not be recommended?
No, it's not a suitable place on the 6 to 12 month view, because even though it has managed to reduce volatility, it doesn't mean volatility is zero. Things can happen which can cause its unit price to decline sharply, hopefully less sharply than many other investments at that time, but it can happen. So if your horizon is 6 to 12 months, no. If your horizon is 6 to 12 months, you want to be in a money market fund or that sort of thing. You don't want to be in any other type of fund.
Ian McLeod says, how long is forever in your forever fund? How many forever companies have died in our lifetime?
Many, many, many. And that's why I try and, you know, you're going to get this wrong. When you say 10 stocks forever, I'm sure you're going to get something wrong along the way, but you can get the odds on your side, which is the best you can do as an investor. And if you pick among stocks that have been around for a long time, the odds are that they will be around for a longer time going forward. So these are all businesses which provide things that people want and people need. It's not things they're forced to have. So there's some, you know, attraction to the consumer to these companies. So yeah, in some form or another, I guess these companies will be around for a long time. I mean, some of these companies have been around for 200 years. I mean, Hermé has been around for 200 years. Could it go out of business in the next 10 years? It's possible. Nothing is impossible. That's the thing with investing. There are no certainties. Nothing is certain. You don't know. It's an uncertain environment. All you can do is get the odds on your side, and you can get it on your side by picking amongst these sort of companies in the equity portion, and then also not having all your money exposed to that. You have some bonds as well, and you have some gold, and you have this and that and the other.
Talal's question is, apart from Bitcoin, which other cryptos do you think are worth investing into and why? Now, you did mention other coins.
Yeah. So, you know, there's, I don't know how many coins there are. There are many, many coins. But I think if you look at the broad parameters, one of the things that I've tried to focus is that I want to buy the coins where the verification that is done on the blockchain the coins are a representation of proof of work, not proof of stake so much. I think proof of stake is when, you know, you have a lot of coins and you put them at risk in the verification process. That can lead to manipulation. If it's proof of work, in other words, the computational power you've put into verifying the information in the blockchain and getting the cryptocurrency reward for doing that, I think that is less open to manipulation. So I've stuck with the coins that are proof of work instead of proof of stake. Which is Bitcoin, Litecoin, Bitcoin Cash, And Ripple is the other one that I've got. So I've got those four. But, you know, I could be completely wrong on that as well.
And the impact of quantum computing, perhaps?
Yeah, if they ever come up with a computer like that, it's possible that such a computer could hack the system. But I think we're going to have a lot more problems than that if that happens ever.
Pete, outside of the BizNews conferences and Berkshire Hathaway AGMs, are there any other investment conferences that you attend and you believe add value to your business? It's from Denver.
Yeah, that's a really good question. Off the top of my head, there are a couple of fund management or money management firms that I follow, and I think the chief amongst them is a company called FRMO or Horizon Kinetics, and they have an investment company called FRMO. I think that's a useful place to look for ideas. I think Fairfax is another one that is a useful place to look for investment ideas, or not ideas, not investment ideas as such, but a way of thinking which is sensible and can add value to your process. So those are two that spring to mind. Markel is another one, Canadian insurance, mini Berkshire, so to speak. So there's a couple, yeah. But otherwise, no, that's about it. I think this, for me, this is the most valuable live conference in South Africa. Hopefully I'll get the 10th nod as well.
It's there. It's done. Before we move off Berkshire Hathaway, what is the best book on Buffett for someone to read? Now, I might just throw the snowball at you as a starting point.
Yeah, the snowball would be top of the list. I mean, because I think that's a warts and all biography of him, and I think that's a good place to start. I think there's another book. I think Cunningham wrote it, summarizing basically all the annual general meetings. It's not a thick book, and it's an easy read. I think that's another good one. I forget the name. It'll come to me.
Do you still go to the Omaha Fest?
I took two of my sons there 2 years ago. That was the last one that Charlie spoke at before he passed away last year. I'm not sure I'll go again. I think that sort of time has passed now. Not that the wisdom is not valid anymore, but I think things have changed there. Warren is retired. Charlie has passed away. Things are different, so I'm not sure I'll go there again. I can attend it virtually.
And the Costco AGM, just tell us about that, because you used to go to that as well.
Not the Costco, Charlie Munger's business, what was it called? It was in Los Angeles.
I thought it was Costco.
No, it wasn't Costco. No, it wasn't Costco. It was called, he had a small business, which eventually was subsumed by Berkshire Hathaway. But that was Charlie Munger, no holds barred, and that was fantastic. It was really good.
What did you learn most from those two guys?
I think the value of patience, number one, and the value of just doing the sensible thing. Not getting carried away with the market, swings and roundabouts and ups and downs. I mean, if you used to go to those conferences and you would sit there and Buffett would very clearly explain his thinking process and it would just sound logical and almost easy until you had to try and do it yourself, of course. Then you get swayed by emotion and people around you and all that sort of thing. But just, if you can just pick up like 20% of the values that they applied, Munger and Buffett applied to their investment process and their investment thinking, I think that sets you ahead of the game, very well ahead of the game.
Dino's probably the last question for this segment. That clock's wrong. If you look at 11:27.
No, that's
that
11 tells minutes you took from me.
Yeah, that's what I took from you. Well, gone forever. He asks, with the likes of Blackstone now representing more than $1 trillion in assets under management, private market assets alternatives are one of the world's largest investment themes at the moment. You spoke a lot about liquidity today and your view of its importance. This is a consideration which I think is more important for South Africans than investors abroad, and it comes at a cost. In this context, what is your view on things like private credit and private equity as mechanisms to extract outperformance?
I think I'm a private equity investor myself. I invest in private businesses. I think it's a wonderful way of investing. It's a wonderful way to access unique businesses and great management cultures. However, it is not a liquid investment. If you sit with a bulk of your wealth in private equity and something happens, you need to get hold of a portion of your wealth. It's very hard. You become a forced seller of assets. And that's never a good place to be in. So what I'm trying to do with a cockroach is provide a liquid store of increasing wealth over time. And that's different to private equity and private credit, which are very good investment strategies in their own right, but they're different, mainly because of liquidity characteristics.
David's question, which will be the last one now. Any comment, please, on the MTN saga?
The MTN saga. Is that now the MTN Zakheli saga or the Iran saga? Or
I would imagine Iran, U.S. court cases.
Look, Iran, I think if you'd stand back and forget about our preconceived ideas about countries, good countries, bad countries, and so on. Many countries have bad governance, bad politicians running the place. Iran is one of them. That doesn't mean the country itself was bad and the people there are bad. And I think providing telecom services in a country like that is a valid service. Having said that, there are now sanctions. You can't get money in or out, so MTN is stuck there. You know, even if MTN vehemently disagree with being in Iran, which they might do at this time, they can't get out because you can't get any money out. You can't sell anything. Iran is pretty much more firmly sanctioned than Russia, for instance. But I think one should separate, when you invest, you should also separate your ethical standards from your, or your moral standards from your, from your business standards. Not saying that you should be unethical in your business dealings, but, a country's rulers do not reflect on the country themselves. And I think sanctions and sanctioning other countries doesn't work. I don't think it's a good thing to do because you're hurting the people who are most vulnerable generally, and you're not hurting the politicians, and you're not, the Ayatollahs in Iran are, they couldn't care about sanctions. But the people on the ground there that are trying to build businesses and deliver services to people, to other customers and people in the country, are hamstrung and they can't. So then ordinary people in the country are hurt by sanctions a lot more than the Ayatollahs and those people. So for me, it's a bit of a situation where I wish MTN could run a normal business there, and I would encourage them to do so if they could, but they can't. But they also can't get out. So, what are they to do?
Thank you, Pete.
This BizNews production is brought to you by Brenthurst Wealth. Building wealth and protecting legacy since 2004. Invest better with Brenthurst.